You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And even though it's been raining last week, it is sunny at my house right now.
Rainy and cold earlier this week. And just in case you all are wondering what the low temperatures have been at night, because we talk so much about that here, this morning's temperature at the weather station nearest to me was 34 degrees.
On March frost, 19th, you had frost.
On March 19th. And on March 18th, we also had frost out in the country. 36 degrees yesterday morning. So those have been out in the open areas in the mid to upper 30s, in town around 40. We're getting closer to those magic temperatures, folks, but we aren't quite there yet. However, we've got a major change in the weather coming up here. As Lois and I are preparing this show on March 19th, the for broadcast on March 20th, which is that the first day of spring? No, that's March 21st. Happy spring. By the time you listen to this, it'll officially be spring. It's 48 degrees right now and clear. It looks like it's going to be some cloud cover today, going up to a high of 60 degrees. Tonight, which is, of course, Wednesday night before you hear the show, chance of showers, then mostly cloudy, dropping down to 42. Thursday, day of the program, 62 degrees and mostly sunny. Thursday night, partly cloudy, 41. Hey, we're going to bump over 40 finally. Friday, 65, mostly sunny. Friday night, 43, partly cloudy. Here we go. Saturday, 69 degrees, mostly sunny. Saturday night, 46 degrees, partly cloudy. According to the National Weather Service, on Sunday, the temperature here will be 74 degrees. Degrees and sunny. Oh my, will we be busy. Sunday night, 49 degrees. Monday, 79 degrees. Monday night, 52 degrees. And Tuesday, 80 degrees. So we're going to go from a high in the 50s a couple days ago to 80 degrees on Tuesday. It certainly is going to feel like spring here. Let me see if I can get the extended forecast. I think we're going to be even warmer as we get to the middle of the week. Extended discussion Sunday through Wednesday, ridging, that's the magic word that means sunny and warm, is expected to amplify across interior Northern California through the end of the weekend into early next week. More pronounced warming anticipated throughout the extended forecast as dry weather persists. A period of breezy north winds may develop Sunday as that ridge begins to amplify. Gusts are only expected to be about 15 to 20 miles an hour over the wind-prone areas. That's us. Temperatures will feel very reminiscent of summer, says the National Weather Service, over the weekend. I don't know. To me, summer, 80 degrees. No, summer here is a little warmer.
That's 100.
Yeah, a little warmer than that, but that's okay. We'll be reminiscent of summer over the weekend and into next week as the highs push into the low 80s across the Sacramento Valley by Sunday. Above normal temperatures appear by Saturday, continuing through the early week with a 50 to 80% probability of high temperatures hitting 80 degrees. I love the way they put this, across the northern and central Sacramento Valley on Sunday and Monday, and continuing to be warmer by Wednesday. They will start to cool off by a few degrees, with only a few areas of minor heat risk over western Stanislaus County. National Weather Service is getting very granular in their detail here. Remember, yes, Mom, to stay hydrated and wear sunscreen as we experience an early taste of summer weather. So you know.
And remember, that's not that he's talking about out there. You know, a week or two away.
Yes.
He's not talking about today.
Yes. However,
but the today question is, it's going to be dry.
Yes.
How are we doing on water in the ground here in Davis?
Well, moisture is okay in normal soil. Your garden, if you dig down, you'll find there's plenty of soil moisture there from the off and on rains we've been having. Containers, however, are drying out rapidly. For example, I came home the other day. I have many, many, many container plants around, and I've just been doing nominal watering here and there, the smaller thing. Everything needed water yesterday evening as I went around. So we're back to the time of year where you need to check containers daily, especially smaller ones. They may not need water daily, but in a pot, something can certainly dry out quickly. Those night temperatures are the key thing we're looking at there. We've had a lot of people coming in, obviously, every sunny day, sometimes wearing 2, 3, 4 layers.
Is it time to plant tomatoes?
Wanting to know where the tomato plants are. And our simple answer is they're in the greenhouse where they belong when it's in the 30s at night. I don't think it's good for little tomato seedlings to be out in the open. So let me tell you a little experiment I did a couple weeks ago, about 4 weeks ago. We had some young tomato seedlings in the little 3 and 4 inch pot. So I brought some home and I put half of them in my little pop-up greenhouse and half of them outside the little pop-up greenhouse, exposed to the open sky. Now, we have gotten down to frost or close to it out in the open on my property. Out in the meadow, there's sparkly frost, very, very pretty in the morning. The plants out in the open have turned purplish. They weren't killed or harmed, but they've turned purplish because of an internal phosphorus issue related to the cold temperatures. They haven't grown a bit. They still look exactly like they did when I brought them home. 10 feet away inside the pop-up but unheated greenhouse, they're still nice and green. They also haven't grown a bit because of the night temperatures. So had I purchased these as a normal customer and bought them to bring home and put in the ground, I'd probably be pretty disappointed by their performance so far. They're not injured. I shouldn't say they're not visibly harmed by the cold weather, but they're certainly not growing, and you certainly wouldn't have gained anything in particular. And I think the ones out in the open have been set back a bit. I'm going to transplant those. I'm going to put them in the greenhouse for their own sake, and I'm sure they'll be fine within a couple of weeks. But taking little seedlings, exposing them to very cold night temperatures is not optimal. That's kind of where we're at with our conversations with people. We're now at the stage of the vegetable gardening nursery season, where people are collecting their plants, they're gathering them, they're buying the varieties they want, they're beginning to get them together and put them hopefully in a warm, sheltered location, planning to plant them out later. That's fine. Taking them home right now, sticking them in cold soil, you're certainly not going to gain anything. You would probably actually set those plants back. But boy, nurseries are full of vegetable plants. If you want to buy your tomatoes, fine. I just got an availability list from a grower who has 19 different kinds of squash and melons. Way too early for those. Way too early to even buy them. Because if you buy them, by the time they're ready to go in the ground, they'll be really root bound. And this is really important. If it's in the cucumber family, cucurbitaceae, if it's a cucumber, melon, squash, if it's root bound, don't plant it. Just go get another one. That plant will be stunted all season. So don't buy those early. Pepper plants to eggplants, which are kind of intermediate, if you have them and it's getting cold at night, you better bring them closer to the house or even indoors. And here's the thing, folks, there's going to be plenty of them out there. I appreciate the urgency that we all feel about getting our vegetable gardens planted, but let's not harm the plants. Let's just wait till it's the right time for the different plants. There are some things you can put in now. Green beans, carrots, radishes, things like that. There's some things you can buy now and hold in warm microclimates around your house where it makes a huge difference. But there's others where you might as well just wait. You know, it only takes like 5 days for a squash plant to germinate from seed. So there's not going to be any shortage of them. And it's certainly too early to get those here in USDA Zone 9, Sacramento Valley, Northern California. Okay, we got a lot to talk about today. Go ahead, Lois. You had an announcement.
I have an announcement from the Master Gardeners, and this is another one of their Thursday Zoom workshops, and they are having one on May 22nd, which is this weekend, and it's Janet Arias, who is talking about vermicomposting. Vermicomposting? Well, what it means is you take worms and you feed them food scraps and they turn it into lovely stuff for your garden.
If you say it right, then they'll understand where vermicomposting comes from. If you take worms.
Oh, worms. I know about vermiculture.
Yeah.
So this is a cross between vermiculture, growing worms, and composting, turning stuff into good stuff. Okay. So if you are interested in this, you can write for the link at jarias4447@gmail.com.
Okay. I have a yes, go ahead.
No, that's fine. That's that one. Now let's get to that exciting one that you've got.
Yeah. This is a message that came from the DJ at Yolo County Breakdown, who goes by the name Rocky Outcrop, which as a geologist kid, I think is one of the coolest DJ names on KDRT. And Rocky says, I have two extremely exciting special guests coming up on Yolo County Breakdown that I would love to get promoted on your shows. You bet, Rocky. Here we go. On Friday, March 28th, Rocky will be joined by the undisputed heavyweight champion of the banjo world, Bella Fleck. Any of you out there know who this man is? You're already jumping up and down going, oh my God, on a radio program in Little Davis, California. Bella
in
Fleck,
person?
In person is a genre-defying master of the banjo, one of the most honored musicians in the history of the Grammy Awards with 19 wins spanning bluegrass, country, pop, jazz, classical, and world music genres. Bella Fleck's impact on banjo playing cannot be overstated as he took the Earl Scruggs style and expanded into musical universes without boundaries. His latest album, which is set to be released on May 16th, is his first foray into Latin jazz and teams him up with virtuoso Colombian harpist Edmar Castaneda and Mexican drummer Antonio Sanchez. They call themselves Beat Trio. Beat Trio. They are playing dates on March 29th and 30th at a theater, Presidio Theater in San Francisco. And he'll be playing that on Friday, March 20th, joined in the studio by Bella Fleck. That just stuns me. And then on Friday, April 4th, I'll have my first ever guest, who is a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. We got some heavyweights here. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Jorma Kaukonen. Jorma is an icon of 1960s rock and roll and a member of Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna. How old do we have to be? I knew both of those bands. Jorma is a master of fingerstyle blues guitar with deep roots in acoustic blues and country music. In recent years, he has partnered with his longtime friend, John Hurlbut, and they tour as an acoustic duo that plays country, bluegrass, and blues at the highest level. They're performing April 4th and 5th at Sweetwater in Mill Valley, April 7th at the Crest Theater in Sacramento, and they will be on Yolo County Breakdown. So to find the timing of that show, just go to the schedule guide at kdrt.org. Well, that's a pretty exciting announcement. If you know who Bella Fleck is, you know how amazing this is.
Okay. I do have one announcement. Keith wrote to us with a sad note. He said that San Marcos growers are going out of business and they've been around since the 70s. This is a wholesale grower in Santa Barbara. And really, I'm looking at their website and they have amazing stuff. So, Don, I'm sorry, you're going to lose out on one of your favorite wholesale.
Well, they don't actually deliver up to us, but I've used their website as an amazing resource on California native plants and Mediterranean plants and so on forever and ever. This is one of these cases where I really hope they'll at least preserve the website because it is a phenomenal resource for gardeners, not just in Southern California. We're losing a couple of major native plant growers in California. They're one of them, and a couple others we can certainly talk about. This is a generational thing at this point. I think they've been there for 50 years, something like that. The property is being sold for development, which is what happens to nurseries, unfortunately. So that's very sad news, but go check out San Marcos Growers website. And as with Las Palitas Nursery, it's just one of those ones I refer to all the time. If you have your copies of the Sunset Western Garden Book and you're looking up California native plants, there aren't as many as you would hope. They also aren't, you know, the newest edition is at least 10 years old now. A lot of the Mediterranean plants are not there. A lot of the South African plants are not there. So these become the resources you go to. A business that has an outstanding website where they conserve that kind of information. So if you're listening, San Marcos Growers, one, we love you. You've been an amazing resource over the years, and please keep your website active. That would be great. Or let's all back it up real quick.
Okay. So the next thing I have is I have a note from Don from a long time ago, and it says, here are some lessons from our 2024 vegetable garden. And so these were just a couple of quick notes he jotted down. He said, watch the ET rates and adjust your watering accordingly. And we'll talk about ET rates later on as it gets into warmer weather. Then I like this one. A 24-pound watermelon is too big for most people.
Yes, indeed. I grow watermelons every year. I think we talked about this a few weeks ago, but we're getting close to the planting time on this. So I want you all to think about this. Most commonly, the people I'm talking with who want to plant a watermelon or a pumpkin, it's a parent with a kid, and that's great. You definitely should grow them at some point, and we can talk about that. All of those are plants that take up a lot of space. Well, I grow watermelons every year, and last year we did 8 hills of watermelons. I wanted, well, one year I did 30 8 hills of watermelons. I wanted to try these different varieties and compare them. And I did one called Sangria, which is really, really good, and one called Crimson Sweet, which was very, very good. Those two in particular, I was very impressed by. And I'm pretty sure it was the Crimson Sweet where all of them were over 20 pounds. Okay, a 20-pound watermelon is a lot of watermelon to eat all at once. And once you cut into a watermelon, you know, it doesn't keep real well. So these are watermelon varieties, old-fashioned ones, although Sangria is a pretty modern variety. Really good texture, very, very sweet, very productive. Each meal produced two or three of these. And they all kind of ripen within the same 1 to 2 week period. So you better be having some outdoor parties in late August, early September. I will tell you one other really important thing I've learned over the years, and I'm sure I've mentioned this, but it bears repeating. Look at the label of the variety you're planting the day you plant it. Actually, what I've taken doing is I take a picture of the label the day that I plant it, so I can scroll back if I ever have to find out. Check the number of days that it says to harvest, which is going to be 85, 90 days to harvest. And watermelons take a long time. The problem is they look like they're ready about 10 days before they are. The rind color gets where you think it is, or where your five-year-old kid thinks it is, and it's not. So the day you plant it, mark your calendar for the earliest day it could possibly be ripe. It'll say on the label 85, 90 days. Count out, do this together as a family project. Mark your calendar for that date. And when the kid comes into the house and says, I think the watermelon is ready, go, ooh, no, it's going to be at least 10 more days. Because I can tell you from bitter experience, when you pick that watermelon 7 to 10 days early, it's not edible. It's not even close to edible. It hasn't even turned color on the inside. So you really have to let it go as long as you can. And well, you have a little leeway on that once you reach that magic date from what you marked is 5, 6, 7 days over which you can pick it. It starts to get poorer quality if you go too far. So, well, many people will tell you all these rules for how to know when a watermelon is ripe. They're bunk. I can tell you they don't work unless you are a professional watermelon harvester. All of them assume that you have experience with this or something comparative. So thump it on the side. It sounds hollow. Compared to what? Compared to the other one that doesn't sound hollow? Come on. So mark your calendar, check the date when it looks like it's ready, and don't harvest until you've reached that magic date. More to the point, anything more than about 15 pounds, that's going to be a lot of watermelon to eat all at once. So this year, I'm going to be testing all of the single serving watermelons that are out there. There's a bunch of these on the market. The melon itself is maybe 5 pounds. That sounds just about ideal. But for fun, if you ever have the room and the opportunity, I highly recommend growing at least once in your life, especially when you have kids, a watermelon and a pumpkin. Not in the same bed. Watermelon and a pumpkin. They run like crazy, which is fun to watch. The fruit develops very rapidly, which is really cool. But you just got to remember that, you know, in the case of watermelons, harvest is a little dicey. In the case of pumpkins, doesn't matter because you're not really eating them. So it's just when they look ready, they're ready. Each of them is very space consuming. And just one more little note about watermelons. They're the lowest growing member of the melon squash family. The foliage only stands a few inches above the ground, whereas pumpkins may be 12, 16, 18 inches high. If you plant a watermelon with other members of that family, they will overshadow the watermelons and you won't get good results. So they need a whole open area of their own. One thing I did test for you all is how much space it takes to get one or two watermelons. Each hill occupied an area approximately 6 by 6. The plant filled an area about 6 by 6 that you need to have unshaded, uncrowded, all on its own. So if you have a small backyard, that's maybe, you know, half of your vegetable garden, just to get a couple watermelons, sure, do it for fun. But bear in mind, it's probably not your most efficient use of space, but everybody should do it at least once.
You said that horrible word, unshaded, which means I was thinking, well, you know, I got that whole area that's covered in wood chips. That would be nice to keep the melons off the ground. And I could, but now it's shaded, of course, because we put the wood chips under the tree.
Yeah, melons, okay. And everything in that family needs full sun. That's actually really important. And they also need deep watering. So this is the kind of thing what I plant in a sequence that we've outlined before. One of the last things that I put in typically are the real, truly tropical plants like watermelons are. They go in June. You know, I'm not in any hurry to get them planted. And I generally put them on the same line as my tomatoes rather than on the same line as my peppers and cucumbers and things like that, because watermelons are deep rooted. And if you can deep water them, the vines will grow with extraordinary vigor. It's actually very fun to watch, and you'll get better results. So they should be where you can give them several gallons of water all at once each time you irrigate them. Not every day, maybe once every 5 or 6 days, depending on your soil, but deep water them. So they're better, in my opinion, on the same line with your tomatoes. There's the vegetables that need a lot of water, your cucumbers, your bell peppers, things like that. I may water them daily, very frequently, but the deep-rooted ones like watermelons can be on the same line as your tomatoes. What was the other lesson I learned?
Okay. Well, the last note that he had in his lessons from 2024 is green beans do best early and late in the season, but not during the July heat.
We had a question.
And we talked about that the other day.
Yeah.
But I wanted to lead into our next question, which comes from, let's see, it is Nina or Nina, not sure which, up in Placerville. Yeah. And Nina writes, "Hello. I just learned about the Davis Garden Show at a rose pruning class I took at the El Dorado Master Gardener's Demonstration Garden in Placerville. Oh, cool. I have been happily listening to you ever since." So here's my question. We live in Placerville at 2,200 feet elevation. Last year, we had a bumper crop of okra and summer squash, much to our delight, but our lima beans and Italian green beans failed miserably. Since we can't find either of these fresh at the store or even at the farmer's market here, we were very disappointed. We grew our beans from seed. They came up, started to grow up the wire mesh, bloomed, and shortly after we took this photo, came completely engulfed in aphids. Oh, we only got a handful of beans all season. Over the summer, to get rid of at least some of the aphids, we tried spraying the plants with water, with neem oil, and even pesticides because we were desperate. Mm-hmm. None of them seemed to even dent the robust population of aphids. I don't know if the aphids were why we didn't get beans, but this year we'd like to prepare to grow bean plants that actually produce beans. Do you have any advice? Thank you and keep up the good work.
Thank you. And I'm glad to hear you found the Davis Garden Show. And I think the El Dorado Rose folks are some of the most amazing around, actually. The issue I've had with green beans is high temperatures in particular, and this is an increasing problem. So last year, for example, I planted green beans and I got some crop. I plant them early. March is okay here, not in Placerville. April is fine. May is a common time that people plant them, and they grow fine and they flower. We'll get to the aphid thing in a minute. And if the temperature is above about 90, the flower just doesn't set well. And so when I first moved here, I would plant them in March and we'd get good yield into let's say early July. And then there would be a gap in production on the pole beans and they would come back into production again in the late summer and early fall. But in that time, the aphids and the leafhoppers and the whiteflies can become a real nuisance on green beans. So my own practice now is to plant the bush variants of green beans that you can buy. Pole Lake is available in both pole and bush, and Blue Lake is the best green bean for the Sacramento Valley in general. I'll say that right there. It's more heat tolerant than Kentucky Wonder, which is kind of the other one. There's a bunch of other green beans out there like Provider, Tender Crop, and Royal Burgundy, and I do grow those. But Blue Lake is just the most reliable and consistent. But it won't produce in July or into August here. That's been my experience with it. So what's the point in having a pole bean that's running all over the place and getting aphids if it's not going to produce anything until late summer? So my pattern now is an early planting of bush beans. Some of them go in right when I plant the tomatoes, for example. I'll put two or three bush beans right around the base of a tomato plant. And by the time the tomato is up and filling the cage, the bush beans have grown, flowered, produced, and are done. And I just cut them off at that point. And every 2 to 4 weeks, I plant some more somewhere. I generally stop planting bush beans by the time we get into mid-June. And I have frequently done a late planting of them mid to late August and gotten very good results with that one as we get into the end of September, early October. But the pole beans will drive you crazy. And this black aphid, black bean aphid is a very frustrating pest. It is much tougher than the aphids that get on your roses. It's not like those little soft pink and green aphids that you get on your roses and other plants in the spring. It seems to have a harder exoskeleton and it seems to be just more able to take adverse conditions, high temperatures, higher temperatures for reproduction than the other types of aphids. Most aphids have a, a fairly narrow temperature range in which they reproduce. That one seems to go well into the summer. And by July, your plants are coated with them and ants are moving them everywhere. And yeah, insecticides that we have available simply don't really work that well on them. So the bottom line is plant your beans at the beginning, for the beginning and the end of the season. And midsummer, you're probably not going to get great results. If any of you have had results with green beans, certain varieties that have done really well for you, please send us the information at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. Of the two widely grown green beans, Kentucky Wonder is more heat sensitive, doesn't produce as well in high temperatures than Blue Lake. I have that direct experience by side-by-side trials. So if you're choosing between them, Blue Lake is a better choice than Kentucky Wonder for us here in the high temperature Sacramento Valley. The other thing to remember is you buy them, look at the label, and it will either say pole or bush. And I'm pushing you all towards the bush beans because they're easier. They produce all at once. You get 12 to 15 beans off of each little plant. So plant as many as you need for whatever your family uses, and do new plantings every 2 to 4 weeks, and just skip the midsummer part. That's my best advice to you, because that way the bush beans just don't get the black aphid as badly. And of course, you pull the crop out, or you cut it off is what I do when you're done. So you don't have this ongoing increasing population as the season goes along. I have observed these black beans, black bean aphid on the beans that are the pole beans. And well, there's a lot of parasitism going on by beneficial insects, and there's a lot of things landing to feed on them. They keep reproducing to the point that it'll just drive you crazy. So will I think the steps you've taken, the vigorous rinsing with water, the various low impact pesticides like soaps and neem oil and things like that, there are certainly an option worth considering. I think just kind of skipping the mid part of the season is my best advice for you.
And looking at the photo that Nina sent, which is very useful. Thank you very much. And she says she's up in Placerville, and I'm seeing the landscape outside the fence.
Yeah.
And let me describe this. She has raised planters that are, it looked to be about 3 or 4 feet tall, quite tall, with a walkway in the center. And then on the outside edge of each of the planters, there is a fence. A huge fence.
I'm guessing,
I mean, that thing must be 12 feet tall. It's huge.
Yes, I'm guessing,
from the ground.
I'm guessing deer are a major factor in gardening in Placerville.
Yeah. And boy, is this, and there's all the drip lines, and it's all laid out so nicely. I hope that you'll keep sending us pictures this year as to what you're doing and how it went.
Now,
and I like Don's idea of simply cut down those bush beans and let that area be fallow for a few months until you plant them in the fall.
One year I grew a 40-foot row of pole beans because my vegetable garden was laid out in 40-foot rows at that time. And it was a mild summer, and we got way more beans than we knew what to do with. But I can tell you that the midsummer quality wasn't that great. So beans like a lot of water. Beans and peas are what we like to call mild season vegetables. Peas like the cool end of the mild season, beans like the warm end of the mild season, but neither of them like freezing weather or extremely hot weather. The pulses, as they call them, the peas and the beans, are generally really happy in our 65 to 85 degree temperature range, like most people. Once we get up about 85 to 90 and above, they do get stressed. And in the case of green beans in your garden, if you happen to be in an area where they do well through the summer, they need a lot of water. This is really important. So if they happen to get drought stressed, and that is likelier to happen in a raised bed than just in the open garden bed, that could be a factor in, you know, your yield. But the plants would look stressed. You'd probably know that they needed something. So just bear in mind that when you have raised beds such as these, which look about 3 feet high, and they're probably filled with soil that was brought in, you do need to water frequently. And I'm, you know, already having this conversation with people, so we'll just put this out there. It's very common for raised planters, especially in their first couple of years, when it's new, fresh, essentially potting soil that you fill them with, you very commonly have to water daily. You don't have to water very long every day, 30, 35 minutes with a drip system may be adequate. You're going to have to test that and maybe get a moisture meter and poke around after an irrigation and see how it distributed. We've certainly talked about that many, many times. Raised beds are like containers. You can build the soil. You could enhance its ability to retain moisture and its ability to retain nutrients, but that takes a couple of years of mulching and growing cover crops and cutting those things off instead of pulling them out so the roots break down, growing more things like beans and peas because they enhance the nutrients in the soil. So you can make soil out of it, starting with what is essentially sand and compost. but it takes a little while. And until you get there, you almost always have to water daily. My old friend Fred Hoffman and I, he was on the radio in Sacramento, now has the podcast. By the way, we just had our annual Tomato Talk podcast. So check out Get Growing with Farmer Fred, where he and I covered, according to his notes, 41 varieties of tomatoes in 1 hour podcast. He moved into town and he does raised beds, and I'm out in the country with gardening out in the open. And the difference in how we water is based on that. He initially had to water every day for 35 to 40 minutes every day. When you add all that up, it's not all that much more water than I'm putting on. I can just put it on in my garden kind of all at once, and I can go 5, 6, 7 days before I have to do it again. So we're both giving the plants what they need. But when you have raised beds, you have to learn to calibrate the irrigation to your soil type and your climate. And that may mean daily watering or every other day. But again, you don't have to run it as long as you might think. You just have to make sure you're getting adequate depth of watering when you do. So poke around, dig. He has a $150 moisture meter, which you can read about on his website, that he uses to make sure he's getting the depth of watering. And you don't have to have that. You can take a trowel the next day and dig down out there and see what's going on. But bear in mind that you've created a very artificial soil situation with raised beds. And while this may not pertain to the problem with the beans, it can be an issue with anyone doing things in raised planters because of the difficulty of retaining nutrients and retaining moisture.
So, Don, I had some disappointing news. I got a postcard from Capital City African Violet Society. And these are folks that have that event every year where you can go and get the most beautiful African violets. And the postcard says, "Dear friends, thank you for your many years of loyalty and visiting us during the spring sale. But it's not going to happen this year." Unfortunately, this year we were not able to get plants for the sale and therefore are unable to have our 2025 show and sale. And we wanted to let you know so you could, take it off your calendar. But keep April 2026 on your calendar because they should be coming back.
Okay. And you can take leaf cuttings of your favorite African violets that your friends have or that you have. And they're one of the easiest things in the world to root.
And they have a website, thecapitalcityviolets.org. And there's also the Delta Gisneriads, and there's a bunch of things. So check out their website, but don't go over for the show.
Okay, they won't be there. We have a listener who has all shade. We have a listener who has all shade in her garden, other than Lois, and who often comments when I see her because she's also a very good customer. You guys always talk about tomatoes and vegetables and things like that. I don't have any sun, so that's frustrating. Well, not that you should stop talking about tomatoes and stuff, but I have all shade, so I'm always happy when you talk about shade plants. You know what? Let's talk about shade plants.
Well, okay.
Okay.
You know, we started this list a little while ago. The title of it is "Some of My Favorite Plants for Planting in the Shade of a Tree with Possible Root Competition." Flowers would be nice.
Flowers would be nice. Yes.
There's a whole lot of flowers would be nice. And there's a whole lot of things in here.
What this actually is a list of the plants that I have growing in the shade on my farm. My house is underneath a 70-foot London plane tree. Most people call it a sycamore. Enormous London plane tree. And nearby is an enormous paradox walnut. It is 120 feet across. It's stunning. And I have a whole bunch of trees down the driveway. I shade all around the house because that's how I keep my house cool. I don't actually even need air conditioning most of the time here. But as the listener knows, and others, and Lois knows, shade can be more challenging. We don't have that many plants that give us nice color in the shade or nice foliage. I mean, it's just not as long a list of things. And also, there's a key question that I have to ask people when they come in and say, "I have shade." My first question is, what causes the shade? Is it like the mulberries I lived under in my first house where almost nothing would grow? That's a very short list of things that worked under those fruitless mulberries, although there were plants that did. Or is it like the high filtered shade of a London plane or sycamore tree where, yes, dappled sunlight actually gets through and touches the leaves now and then. So it's a brighter shade because shade is not a binary thing. It's a spectrum. You have shade that is north side under an overhang. Oh, that's a tough one. Versus the lovely shade of birch trees, which is only maybe 50% reduction of sunlight. So to some degree, not every one of these plants is going to work for you. But the ones that have really stood out for me, aside from, we'll start with Lois's absolute favorite plant, which is?
A butylon.
There you go. I think we mention it every show.
But it grows in the sun.
It's not optimal in the sun in our climate. It will grow in the sun in lots of areas, but abutilon will take direct sun for part of the day and even into the early afternoon. Flowering maple is a common name. This is that hibiscus relative that we like to talk about here because there's so many kinds and they bloom pretty much all the time.
And I even had one inside for a while. Don thought I was crazy.
Yeah, full sun in the afternoon. There was a landscaper in Davis who occasionally would spec them in yards in full sun, and I would watch with interest. And they would look good most of the year, but during a heat wave, they would look really rough. So I would keep it out of anything after, let's say, 2 o'clock. But they can take total shade. They don't need any direct sun, and they just get stretchier, but they simply never stop blooming. So abutilon is one that here in Zone 9, USDA Zone 9, all over Northern California and Southern California, they're monster plants, actually, of course, very successful. So that's just been one that's been very successful for me, and I have 5 different varieties of abutilon sprawling all over the place under the shade of my lovely sycamore or London plane tree. But a couple of these things that I want to mention for people with smaller yards. Virginia. It has the funny common name of pig squeak, because if you rub the leaves together, it makes a sound like pigs. Apparently, I've never heard pigs make this sound, but it's a shiny leaf. It's a bold texture. It's like a big, bold, wide leaf and dark green, and has really pretty pink flowers midwinter. In fact, they're finishing up their bloom. They typically bloom here January, February into March. Hummingbirds do visit them. I don't know if they're getting anything, but they certainly go to them, probably because they're blooming in the winter. There isn't that much else out there that's doing that. Right nearby that, under my London plane tree, is Campanula porcharskiana. But Campanula in general, the bellflowers, will be a great group of plants for you to look at. And there are ground cover forms. Porcharskiana is probably one of the best known, or Serbian bellflower. Has a nice round leaf, really woodsy looking plant. Very low grower. Once a year bloom, getting ready to initiate those right now, all through April. True blue flowers. And most of the campanulas are blue, purple, lavender, or white. There are some with spiky flowers that are more like a traditional herbaceous perennial, but many ground cover forms. And while they like plenty of moisture, so at least once a week watering, it's a great plant to have around ferns, around clivias, around a lot of these other more larger and more robust perennials.
One of my favorite plants under the shade of the redwood that we have in the yard is the Australian violet. Mm-hmm. Now, is that actually a violet?
It is. It's a true violet, Viola heteracea. It can run. It can cover quite a territory. It's not as bad in that regard as the Viola odorata, which is the sweet violet that most people know, which I have in various places on my property. That one reseeds all over the place. So once you have it, you're never rid of it. The Australian violet, Viola heteracea, runs across the ground. It's only a couple inches high, and it blooms seemingly all the time. It's got that two-tone purple and pale lilac flower all the time, whereas Viola odorata is just a spring bloom. I think Viola heteracea, Australian violet, is actually a great ground cover in shaded areas. And it's not super drought tolerant. It wants, you know, average watering, but it kind of runs around other plants and doesn't run over them. Okay, there's two kinds of ground covers. The ones that go around plants and make a nice cover, and the ones that engulf things, in which case you have some maintenance you have to do. This is a very well-mannered ground cover.
So the Australian violet, which I love, is that something that I plant from seed, or do I have to get little plants and divide them up?
You need to get plants. I have not actually ever seen seed for that plant. I'm sure it makes it, but that's not a way for people to get it. You just buy a single plant or two, and it's one of these things where once it starts running, you can move it around quite easily.
Yeah, I have an area that got unintendedly cleared out, and I want to put stuff in it. And that's where a lot of the Australian violet was, and it's gone now. So I'm going to have to buy some plants then and just
Yeah, they fill in pretty quickly. So,
and the other question is the Viola odorata.
Yeah.
Isn't that the one that has that funny disease now, and the people stopped using it?
It's an insect. Yes, it gets, well, first of all, greenhouse growers who would produce it perhaps for us to sell tell me that spider mites are a huge problem on it, so they don't even grow it. But in the garden, there's a gall midge that causes the leaves to get highly distorted and buckled. Hasn't shown up on my farm, so I'm happy with mine. But when we lived in town, we certainly had that problem, and there's nothing to do about it. Gall midges, what they do is they put a toxin in the leaf that causes the leaf to grow essentially a gall around them. So if you wanted to kill them with anything, you really can't. I mean, even if you spray them with neem or something, it's not going to get at them. And so it really disfigures them. So Viola odorata, the sweet violet, has turned into a A slightly annoying plant that reseeds all over your yard and looks very rough once the gall midge hits it every year. So it's not something that people are typically planting. As I say, I still have the plant and I like it, and they have the wonderful flower. It's a very familiar plant. You know, most people know it from Shakespeare or something like that. It's very easy to grow, but it reseeds prolifically and then it looks rough in the summer. So I don't really recommend Viola odorata. I wouldn't take it out because you can't get rid of it even if you wanted to, but I wouldn't probably go out and plant it intentionally.
So there's a plant that I don't see on this list that I'm surprised to not see. What about the oak leaf hydrangea? Isn't that a shade plant?
You just didn't scroll down far enough. It is there. It's
Oh,
on
I
page. It's
didn't?
on page two. Yes, oak leaf hydrangea. We've already had the people coming in with the hydrangea questions. Now, bear in mind, folks, hydra of hydrangea means water. Hydrangeas need lots of water. I'm told they even water them back east. So this is a plant that needs supplemental irrigation, apparently even in rainy summer climates. I could be wrong about that, but the common hydrangea that grandma grew, that's what I always call them, grandma's hydrangeas, the big mop head hydrangea that's very familiar to everybody. High water, if they get stressed, the leaves burn. They look burnt all summer. They're not really thrilled about the density of our soil out here, and they're certainly not thrilled about the dry heat that we have. So they definitely need to be in the shade if you're going to grow them. Morning sun at most, light shade all day is actually optimal. The place you see really good hydrangeas, Land Park in Sacramento, with a great high canopy of elms and sycamore trees, the fabulous 40s in Sacramento, places where there's a mature canopy, but a high canopy, because they need enough light to bloom, but they don't want to be in bright, hot sun. Morning sun is fine. The east side of a house is ideal. If you happen to like those kinds of hydrangeas, folks, there's at least 500 varieties out there now, all ranges of color and interesting appearance, but mostly what you're looking at is pink, white, purple or blue. Blue is very hard to sustain in the Davis area because the pH of our water is very high. So they tend to go from blue back to a sort of a ruddy pinkish purple. You might as well just start with pink, red, or white rather than trying to grow blue hydrangeas in the Davis-Dixon woodland area. Very hard to keep them blue. And they look burnt and they get powdery mildew. And there's a lot of issues with hydrangeas. A properly grown hydrangea is an amazing plant, but they can look really rough if you just forget to water them 1 week. That's really all it takes to scorch the foliage. If you're shopping nowadays, you'll find ones with names like Endless Summer or the City Line series. These are repeat blooming hydrangeas. So unlike your grandma, which only got one big grandma's hydrangea, which only got one long spring bloom, what we now have is ones that repeat bloom during the summer. They're remontant, as the English like to say. So you don't have to prune them carefully. They'll bloom no matter what, and they tend to stay shorter. So if you're looking for those kind of hydrangeas, fine. My personal preference is for the oak leaf hydrangea, Hydrangea quercifolia. There's a name that exactly tells you, Quercus folia, leaf like an oak. And they have a big leaf that's bold. It does look like a big oak leaf. It is not nearly as fussy about irrigation. Just normal garden watering or even landscape watering is fine. We have found they can take more sun than the regular mop head hydrangeas. And their bloom season is longer because the flowers age nicely. That sounds odd, but when they go from their white to their buff tan color, it's actually attractive. So most people like to leave them as they age. They look like something from a 19th century print. They're very attractive that way. And then when you go ahead and cut them off and you're getting towards fall, they turn this beautiful red fall color, and that hangs all the way through December. So you have a plant that gives you this long season of color. If you don't prune them at all, they get about 6 feet or so. If you prune them back, you can keep them 4 to 5 feet. And there's a dwarf variety that only gets to 4 to 5 feet. So if you're looking for the look of a hydrangea with greater elegance, much more seasonal color and much easier to grow, oak leaf hydrangea, Hydrangea quercifolia, can grow in bright total shade. In other words, a place where it never gets direct sun, but a high shade of a tree, something like that, or full morning sun, even into the early to mid part of the afternoon. So if you want that elegant look of a hydrangea in our climate, I would go with Hydrangea quercifolia.
So my shade, my newly exposed shade area
Former.
that I'm trying to plant is under redwoods. So I have two redwood trees out there and they get water. So this is not a drought situation at all. So in that situation where they're going to get watered, would I be better off with the Camellia japonica or the Camellia sasenqua?
That question just came up at our nursery. Someone had told the customer that the Sasanqua camellias are more tolerant of heat. And this is an enduring garden, I'll say myth. I don't believe they're more tolerant of heat. I think they can take direct sun, but so can japonica camellias. People often underestimate the tolerance of camellias for direct sun. Even in our climate, they can take full sun into the early afternoon. Established plants properly mulched and properly watered can even take full sun for much of the day. But we do like to grow them in the high shade of other trees. Where they come from in the wild, camellias would typically be shaded by high maple trees or something like that. So that kind of bright shade. I don't think personally there's significant differences between japonica, sasanqua, high malus hybrids, reticulata hybrids with respect to how much sun or heat they tolerate. These are plants that would naturally grow in a place where they get rainfall in the summer. So you'll have to provide them with adequate irrigation, where there would always be a mulch of leaves every year, a good foot of leaves piling up around them. That has been my key to success because I have a camellia right under my London plane or sycamore tree, and it's thriving. And it has usually has about 12 inches of decomposing sycamore leaves right underneath it pretty much all the time, especially going into the summer. I think that's really important because they have fine roots. And if those roots dry out, the plant will stress very badly. It's not that they need a lot of water. They just need even moisture. And so while I only water that bed once a week, there's a thorough mulch of decomposing leaves there all the time. And that, I think, is the key to success. And that's going to go for azaleas and some of the other shade woody plants that you might be familiar with. It's not so much that they need constant watering, it's that they can't have that surface inch or two dry out or else they will stress pretty badly. There's a lot of plants that come from high rainfall woodsy environments where there's a constant supply of decomposing organic material for them, probably affects the pH, which is one of the things you're always told. They need this kind of pH. No, they need decomposing organic material all the time. So if you don't happen to have a giant 70-foot sycamore tree over your camellia, mulch it at the beginning of May or sometime around then with compost or something like that to help shade those roots. I think that's really important.
So you know that I got a chip drop and I got a VW's worth of chips still sitting out there,
there you
ready
go.
To go. So would chips substitute for your 6 inches of leaves?
Yeah, anything. And in fact, redwood needles are great. Now, the other question that this customer had was, I think she had a cedar tree and someone had told her, oh, you can't let those cedar needles build up there. They'll something, something, something. I said, you know, ignore that. First of all, no, they don't lower the pH except over maybe a, you know, decades and decades. And even if they did, that would be desirable. We generally want a lower pH for these kinds of plants. They're perfectly fine. They just don't break down quickly. So rake them off, go ahead and plant the tree, rake them back over. Needles from a pine, from a redwood, chip drop, any of those, it's all fine. Because if you incorporated something that's not composted, you can tie up nitrogen and the plant can struggle for a while while that stuff breaks down. But if you just put it on the surface, and retain, and there's moisture under there, it'll break down, as I like to say, at the rate that's appropriate to your soil and your soil organisms, and it will steadily amend the soil naturally. Worms will grow, will crawl up into it and back down. Mycorrhiza quickly invade any kind of natural mulch that you put on the surface. The only kind they don't quickly invade is bark, because bark it contains suberin, which is resists water. So bark is great for shading the soil and walking on, but it doesn't particularly amend the soil at a very rapid pace. Let's put it that way. Compost, great. Leaves, great. Needles, fine. Bark on top of all that, because you want to walk on it, that's actually fine as well. So one of the simplest things you can do in April, early May, for your camellias, your azaleas, this also goes for your citrus and a lot of other woody plants, mulch them with 1 to 2 inches of whatever mulch you prefer. And if you need to walk in the area where you walk, put bark there. But right around the tree, compost, leaves, chip drop stuff, whatever you got is actually fine.
So I'm questioning when I look out, it's my husband's window. And I look out his window and I see this area that's beautiful, lush. And then I see this area that's bare and I'm going to put stuff in it. Should I bring in to you a list of the 4 bushes I'm thinking of planting and the ground cover I'm thinking of planting and see if they're compatible with each other?
Sure, you can email them to us, which is what people do all the time. Send us a list of the plants you've got questions about, and then we can take the time to answer it by email. That's an excellent way to go. redwoodbarn@gmail.com for that particular type of inquiry. Or if you're out there listening and you have questions about plants that would be compatible and you're a Davis Garden Show listener, davisgardenshow@gmail.com. So a couple of plants on my list that I want to just highlight for people looking for color for the shade. Fuchsia triphylla has been phenomenal. I'm a big fuchsia fan, always have been. One of the first groups of plants I got interested in when I was 13 years old was fuchsias, which in coastal San Diego, they were amazing. They turned into practically into trees. Those of you in the coastal areas, the fuchsia mite, gall mite just ruined fuchsias. And you go over to places where fuchsias were all over the place, they're completely gone. Here in the valley, the fuchsia mite has not overwintered, for me anyway, and my understanding is it simply doesn't, so we don't have that problem. But fuchsia triphylla, sometimes sold under the particular cultivar as Gartenmeister Bonstead. My mom called it the firecracker fuchsia. Sun, shade, you name it, it blooms every year. They've gone through the winter, except this year they were hit hard in late January, so they might come back. I'm not absolutely sure. But the amount of bloom you get out of them all the way up until frost is phenomenal. Hummingbirds absolutely love that one. One that I want to mention, and you'll have to look around for it, is Jacobinia or Justicia carnea. This is the Brazilian plume flower. Vivid pink flowers in the shade. My plant is more than 30 years old. It's gone through every major freeze we've had here in the Sacramento Valley, and it was killed to the ground in 1990, and it even came back from that when we got to 16 degrees. So although it's sold as a subtropical plant, my experience with that one is that it will come back, and that gives you a lot of color in the shade. So these are 2 to 3 foot shrubby things that give you bloom. For those of you that don't have room for a camellia or something as big as those woody plants, I should mention ferns that have done very well for me, including our native maidenhair has done extremely well. Our native woodwardia has done well. And right under the shade of my coast redwoods, which have easily a foot and a half of needle buildup in there, I have used the ostrich fern, which is an East Coast native, but does quite well here in California, as long as it gets the mulch in the water. So ferns can give you a soft green texture, really nice color in their own way, great backbone plants to frame this next group of plants. Hellebores, Helleborus orientalis, the hybrids of Valentin rose, Helleborus niger, if you can find it, amazing perennials that give this spectacular bloom. Right now, basically February, March, and into early April, we get the hellebores blooming, and there's so many new varieties on that, I don't even know where to begin. I have one by my front doorstep that's been in the ground for 35 years. It's blooming right now. The plant has gradually grown to be about 2 feet across with just average watering. So the hellebores, and I know folks back east can grow these as well, great choices for the shade. They don't need any direct sun. Very, very easy to grow. And my experience here is just average watering is fine for those. A couple of other just shrubby plants. The Mahonias are great. There's our native Mahonia that blooms December, January, February. That's Oregon grape. Yes, they've been moved to the genus Berberis, so you'll now find them lumped with the barberries. That's appropriate up to the point of one characteristic, which is that they are kind of spiky. So don't plant these right next to your path or anything like that because the leaves are spiny, except for the variety called Caress, which has a soft leaf. So there's some new Mahonias that have the advantages of the others, shiny leaves, shade tolerance, yellow flowers midwinter. There is one that isn't spiny that are uncomfortable to try and deal with. And one Mahonia that's done great for me, although it took a long time to really get going, the shade of Japanese maples, my whole ground cover area under them now is Mahonia repens, Berberis repens. Mahonia repens is a ground cover form of Mahonia. Little yellow flowers, mid to late winter, and just this nice, cool ground cover that helps to shade the roots of my Japanese maples. You were mentioning chiseling out a spot to plant a plant, you know, for your gut root competition from trees. The house where we had the fruitless mulberries, the plant that took that for me was Mondo grass. And I did very well with it. And under the roots of a mulberry, if you've ever lived with them, it's quite a network of roots. So we would just take a trowel, try to find a place where we could chisel out 3 to 4 inches of hole, stick a Mondo grass in there, hand water it until established. It was one plant that took that root competition real, real well. So if you've got deep shade or root competition, Mondo grass is a great ground cover that you can consider. Very, very tough plant. There's lots of other plants that will work in the shade, but I do want to mention two roses. Okay, roses?
Roses in the shade?
Hybrid musk roses. Musk rose is a species. The hybrid musks have a very tiny amount of musk rose in their parentage. The hybrid musks in general are shade tolerant. They're big scrambling plants or sprawling plants, so they take a lot of room, or you can grow them as a climber. The Persian musk is a variant called Nastarana of the hybrid musk roses. It only gets to about 4 feet. It has a wonderful honeysuckle fragrance in the evening, and it will grow in a surprising amount of shade. And the other one is iceberg. This is one of the most familiar roses in the world now. It's that bright white rose that you see planted in mass quantities. It's marketed as a floribunda rose. If you know your rose categories, it's being marketed as that kind of a rose, but it actually is more of a hybrid musk rose. I have one that gets no direct sun. It started out in the sun 25 years ago, but it gets no direct sun now because I always plant trees. And it looks great. It has a more open habit, informal growth, almost like a climber. It blooms constantly right on into the midwinter and even through the winter this year. And so that's iceberg. Your common white, supposedly floribunda rose is actually remarkably shade tolerant. And of course, there's variants that have occurred on iceberg, brilliant pink iceberg, burgundy iceberg, same growth habit, same tolerance for shade, just different colors of flowers. These are spontaneous sports that occur that are now propagated. So there are roses that will take the shade. The key is that they're resistant to mildew and you have a different growth habit. They're more informal. Those of you back east and in the southeast especially, and we can grow these as well, the noisette hybrids that were introduced in the early part of the 19th century, introduced in South Carolina, not even though they sound like they're French, and introduced in from South Carolina, and they can take considerable shade. They almost never get mildew. These are great garden plants if you're dealing with a high shade of deciduous trees. The first place I saw a blush noisette rose was at the Rose Garden at the Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens in Fort Bragg. If a rose doesn't get mildew there, it's not going to get mildew. That climate is mildew city. It's 62 degrees year round and it's always overcast. When they have a sunny day there, people think they're having a heat wave. And in the rather feeble rose garden, the Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens, I looked at, what is this giant shrub over in the corner doing so well? Blush noisette. So if you're listening in a drizzly coastal climate, you're looking for a rose that will grow, bloom, have fragrant flowers, and never get disease problems, look for the noisette hybrids or the musk hybrid roses.
Well, we like to close our show with a saying, and this time I have Uwe Kalani Ola Kahonua.
Really? Now,
this is a Hawaiian language saying, and Olelo is the Hawaiian language, and it translates to, when the sky weeps, the earth lives.
Oh, so when it rains, plants grow.
Yeah, got pray it. For rain. Yeah.
Or in our climate, you have to make the sky weep yourself with irrigation. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
On Wednesdays, 10 to noon, you can check out Sometimes Folk, where host Bill Wagman explores an eclectic range of music, including traditional folk of the British Isles in the U.S., contemporary singer-songwriters on both sides of the Atlantic, and American roots music and some of its lesser-known offshoots. Tune in for a great music mix. Sometimes Folk, Wednesdays at 10 a.m., replays during the week, so for the rebroadcast time, just check out the schedule guide.